Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whose fault is it that the record business is not what it used to be? Major labels might point to a host of new developments over the past couple of decades, from easily duplicated CDs and piracy to illegal downloads and file sharing. But are the record companies also victims of their own bad decisions and their own hubris? Steve Knopper is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. His new book is called Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris.
This book is full of 2020 hindsight of the recent history of the record industry. Can you talk about when it was at the height of its power in terms of market control?
Yes, absolutely. When the CD was introduced in the early 80s, after some resistance from record labels who sort of liked the way that it had gone with the LP, the vinyl LP market, the CD, when it got adopted, meant that the record labels could raise the prices on the CD and also take more deductions out of artist contracts. And that led to, and given that, and given the public having to replace all their record collections and switch over from LP to CD, led to this prolonged boom in the music industry from roughly 1984 to 2000. And the peak was sort of during the teen pop era, when Britney Spears and the Backstreet Boys and so forth were ascended.
Why did CDs become so expensive to buy? Because they were actually cheaper, right, to produce and distribute?
Yes. I mean, they were cheaper to produce and distribute, although, you know, that doesn't include the marketing and publicity and all the different things that go into it. But yes, CDs were basically more expensive because they could be more expensive. You know, the record labels cranked up the price very, very early on. Initially, when CDs were produced, it did cost more money than it cost to make LPs, and it cost more money to make them early on in the early 80s than it does now. But the labels just went ahead with their high prices for CDs, and it worked for a long, long time. They made the people who worked for record labels, the top executives, and some of the artists during that era made a lot of money. And why stop?
Talk for a minute about the initial resistance to CDs, because it's interesting that initially it seems as if consumers were the only ones who really got the potential of these things.
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
Well, the industry-wide resistance initially to the CD, record companies, I know, were worried about duplication and piracy, and even record stores didn't initially want to sell these things.
Yes, correct. Basically, record labels were not really interested in changing the system that they felt worked pretty well already. And that's been a long, I mean, there's been a long history in the record industry, in the music industry, of being resistant to technology, going back to, first, when people didn't want to change over from sheet music to wax cylinders, you know, and there was a resistance to radio, and there was a resistance to cassette tapes. There was a resistance even to the vinyl LP. So that had been going on for years and years. The CD brought its own set of challenges for a couple reasons. First of all, labels kind of had been burned by some technology that they didn't really understand in recent years. You know, quadraphonic sound was something that was a huge flop in the 70s. They were paying very careful attention to the laser disc, which was in the video industry, but it also flopped. And so they weren't super enthusiastic about tearing down all their multi-million dollar LP plants and building these fancy new state-of-the-art clean rooms for tens of millions of dollars all around the country. So there was that resistance. And as you say, there was also a resistance because of piracy, which was something that the record industry had always been paranoid about. They were never super thrilled that people like you and me could get blank cassette tapes and record our LPs onto cassettes like we used to do. And the idea that a CD would be more pristine and allow you to make more perfect copies that way was not a very attractive proposition to them.
And there were some initial efforts to sort of place a little poison on a CD so that if you tried to do this with your computer, you'd have a major problem.
Yes, you're talking about digital rights management,
yeah.
I think, but that came later. Is that what the question has to do with, putting locks on CDs so you can't copy them, you can't easily rip them to your computer or turn them into a compressed MP3 file? So that was an emphasis that the record labels had, but that sort of came later during the Napster era and the Internet era in the late 90s.
And who decided to eliminate the single?
It wasn't a specific person. It was sort of a... I guess centrifugal force. I don't know if that's the right phrase, but eventually, in the late 80s, early 90s, the entire industry sort of came together and realized we're not making any money at all on the single format. And in fact, if we release a single on a CD, it costs us the same to produce as if we release 20 songs on a CD. So let's just get, and consumers aren't really buying it anyway, so let's just get rid of it. And so it just got kind of phased out. There wasn't any one person who made the decisions. Just all the labels kind of saw the writing on the wall. They saw their own finance books, and they just decided that they didn't need it anymore, basically.
And then, of course, the pendulum sort of swung again with the rise of the Internet. How much money were the labels losing to Napster and to the other file-sharing services?
You know, I don't know exactly how much money. I believe that the record industry came out with some estimates around that time. But, you know, basically they just saw that people were stealing music. They saw that where people had, in order to get the song you wanted from the radio in roughly the mid-90s, you had to actually get in your car, go to Tower, and buy it for $15 to $18. But Napster allowed you to cherry-pick that one song for free, and that was a tremendous threat to the business model. And so, you know, all of a sudden they started to see people getting all their music for free through Napster and through other file-sharing services starting in roughly 1998. And the label response to that was, the record industry response to that was, let's just sue this out of existence so we can get back to the lucrative business of selling CDs. And it didn't quite work out that way.
Yeah, it got to the point at one point where the number one Internet search term was not sex, at least temporarily.
Yeah, that was a story that kind of made its way through the media around 1999. I think I wrote a couple of those stories myself where MP3 was the most searched for term on the Internet around that time. And that was evidence that this MP3 thing was a certifiable big deal.
What reasons did most downloaders have for why they did it? Were they all sort of universally bitter about the power of the record companies that they were bypassing?
No. In fact, I don't think so at all. I think there was a contingent of that. I think there was a contingent of people who said, boy, the record industry has been screwing us for so many years, let's get them back. And then there was the other contingent of, you know, everything on the Internet should be free. Information wants to be free. And just for the record, I mean, I should say that I don't necessarily subscribe to either of those views. I believe that some form of copyright is legitimate, and if you are an artist or you sell your work to a company as an artist, you own the control of that whatever work it is. And I do believe that what was going on with Napster and MP3s and so forth in the late 90s, and it still goes on today, is theft, is copyright infringement. So I'm not defending that. However, I do think that I think that Napster, when it came out, was the great thing about the service was not necessarily just that it was free. It was also incredibly convenient, and people could get music that they hadn't heard or rare music that they hadn't found or discovered in years and years and years just right there on their computer. And it was actually also sort of an early version of a social networking system. Napster was kind of a MySpace with chat rooms and people communicating with each other long before there was a MySpace or a Facebook. And it was all built around music. And there were tens of millions of people using this service. And it was incredibly powerful. And I think that the thing that the record labels neglected to do in their zeal to sue everybody and shut all this Internet downloading completely was make a partnership with Napster and create an exciting new business model that's built on customer convenience and need. And they didn't do that, and I think that that's one of the reasons that they've declined since then so dramatically.
Did the people at Napster who had these, something, I think you said 26 million subscribers by the time it was shut down?
Yeah, per month, right.
Yeah. Did they propose any sort of middle ground to the record companies?
Well, there were negotiations that went on between Napster and the record companies, which I talk about in my book. And these kind of peaked in July 2000 with a secret meeting that happened in Sun Valley, Idaho, as part of the larger business conference. And there were a lot of discussions. And, you know, what I conclude in my book was basically the reason these discussions broke down was stubbornness on both sides. I think the labels felt at the time, and to an extent they did, they didn't really see clearly what would happen 10 years later, of course. But I think the labels felt they had all the control, they had all the leverage. And so they were demanding very favorable terms. And the Napster people were saying, you know, we want favorable terms too. And so just on the basic level, I think that the discussions broke down. But in addition to that, there were some difficult personalities on both sides too. And I talk about that in the book. There were some people at Napster, including, you know, Sean Fanning was the guy who created Napster, but his uncle was a pretty difficult guy by all accounts. And the labels had people who were hubristic, and they felt that this was their business, and they weren't going to cede any control to some 19-year-old kid who happened to build a new widget.
A lot of those users ultimately gravitated to iTunes. Can you talk for a minute, I think this is fascinating, about how bold Apple was to step into this business, having never done anything like it before?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I agree with you. The background to that is that by 2002, after the labels had neglected to make a deal with Napster or create their own service that anyone was really interested in, or, you know, really do anything other than kind of aggressively spin their wheels and perhaps purposely spin their wheels, they found themselves in this time period from roughly 98 to 2002 when there really was no legal, legitimate way to buy, you probably remember that period, to buy music online, to download a song legitimately and legally. And this was a very, it's not that labels had to do this, they weren't required by law to do this, but this was a very frustrating period for consumers, even such as myself, who wanted to partake in this great new opportunity that Napster was pointing to, but just were unable to because of the labels dragging their feet kind of on purpose. And so by 2002, Steve Jobs showed up and he started contacting the record labels and saying basically what I just told you. He said, my customers, Apple's customers, are frustrated. They want a way to be able to tap into this amazing new power of downloading music online, but you're forcing them to go to the pirate services. And, you know, the labels, they weren't persuaded by some 19-year-old kid, Sean Fanning, and his people, who, you know, weren't the easiest to deal with necessarily. But Steve Jobs was a different story. Steve Jobs was a rock star. They could talk to rock stars. They'd been doing that for years. and Jobs kind of showed, you know, he invited, beginning with Warner Music, one of the major record labels, he invited executives to the famous Apple headquarters in Cupertino, California. And at one point, they were all sitting around, and he sort of shifted around this computer screen, and he said, take a look at what we've been working on. And it was the iTunes Music Store. And the executives kind of got it right away, and they eventually said, okay, we're going to jump into this deal with Apple. We have to do it. This is the right one. We've dragged our feet too long.
So was Jobs' vision initially that he would make a whole bunch of money selling iPods and that this would be sort of a small subsidiary, or did he in fact see that the real money was going to be in selling that music?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what Jobs saw and didn't see. I mean, he hasn't really come out and said that in great detail, and I actually was unable to do an interview with Steve Jobs. He does very few interviews with press. But I think that what he was trying to do is just build a market for this. I think the iPod actually was created, if I'm not mistaken, the iPod was created before the iTunes Music Store and before the iTunes, you know, the organizing service that we all have on our computers.
And what you could do at that point was take your own CDs and put them into your iPod via the computer.
Right, exactly. You could rip your CDs onto the computer and create a whole library of digital songs and organize them with the iTunes software. And so Steve Jobs, I think what my sense of what he wanted to do, which seems plausible, is that he thought the iPod was a great product and that he could make a ton of money off of the product. But in order to do that, he had to have a music store that legitimized it and also allowed people to buy new music to put on their iPods, because otherwise you were just getting people to rip CDs and do it that way and people pirating, you know, people getting music from Napster or some illegal service, some illegitimate service at the time. And so Jobs decided that in order to have, you know, he had the hardware and he had the software, he just needed the content, and that's when he decided that he had to make deals with the record labels. You know, I'm not sure if Jobs predicted that the iTunes store would take off and sell. I think to date it sold 6 billion downloads.
Steve Knopper.
But he definitely wanted to sell a lot of iPods, and that was what he was after the whole time.
Steve Knopper is with us from Rolling Stone magazine. His new book is called Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. We'll return in a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Steve Knopper. He is just back from South by Southwest, and he is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. His new book is called Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So with a service like iTunes, and you mentioned that they've sold something like 6 billion tracks, obviously Apple gets a cut, but of course the record industry and the artist and everyone involved also gets a cut. Is there significant savings for them in not having to worry so much about production and distribution of hard copy CDs?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. No, the answer is no. And you'd think there would be. I mean, you'd think that it would make sense not to have this huge overhead that you would have to pay for to ship records around and that sort of thing. But the problem is that one of the reasons that the record labels didn't want to make these deals and were suspicious of the internet, I think is a charitable way of putting it, beginning in the mid to late 90s, is because the record labels owned that whole distribution system. You know, every link on the chain, the crates, the warehouses, the trucks, not the retail stores, but they had very favorable deals with the retail stores, such as Tower and even Walmart to an extent. The record labels, the major labels, owned that whole distribution system and had been making tons of money off of that system for decades, starting even in the 60s, you know, starting with kind of the rack jobber way of distributing things in the early 60s and with singles and that kind of old school record distribution system. So to an extent, the idea of just this internet system where an artist makes a song and sends it from his or her computer to the customer's computer with no distribution whatsoever was actually a huge threat. And in fact, you know, that it turned out to be a huge threat because those distribution mechanisms kind of went down and down and down in terms of profits, and some of them were outsourced or sold to other companies. Most of them were, actually. So even today, those very powerful record distribution systems owned by Warner and some of the others are no longer part of the record companies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Steve Knopper. Let's speak to Jason in Dallas. Hi, Jason.
Yes. Thank you for having me. You pretty much just asked the question that I was going to ask. But I wanted to go ahead and expand the question a little further into what about discounting older music that's more classical, not classical in the sense of classical music itself, but, you know, classics like, you know, some old Zeppelin or things like that, which they've already made tons of money off of. Wouldn't it be more profitable for them to go ahead and discount some of those things to make them easier to download? I mean, every music enthusiast should have a copy of some of the older classic stuff, like if you're a rock enthusiast, some of the old Zeppelin stuff, things like that. It's 99 cents a song, and whatever they charge for a whole CD, it just seems ridiculous at this point for some of that older stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I see your point, although I think you're one of the first people that I've heard who's actually suggested that 99 cents is far, far too expensive for one song. You know, I actually think that most people think it's pretty reasonable to buy a song online for 99 cents. But I see your point, and I think the record industry would agree with you. And in fact, about 2 months ago, finally, after years of pushing Apple and Steve Jobs, this variable pricing scheme took effect at Apple, at the iTunes store. And so there are now, instead of just 99 cents, there are now three price levels for a single. For kind of hot hits, it's $1.29. And for classic material, for catalog material, as you suggest, it's now 69 cents. And then there's a middle price of 99 cents. So, you know, that's a little better. And I also think that if you go to Amazon, you can see, not consistently, but you're starting to see some really, really interesting deals. I just did a story on this a month or so ago about how, you know, I went on there 1 week during January and I saw the classic album by Elvis Costello, My Aim Is True, on sale as a digital download for something like $1.98. And U2, if I'm not mistaken, U2 sold its album on Amazon as a digital download, its new album, for $4.99. So we are starting to see these discounts for downloaded music in certain cases. And the idea is, I think, that first of all, you compete better. It makes it easier for people to make the decision of, I'm going to actually buy a digital song or an album rather than go to a pirate service and get it for free. And I think that makes sense. But also, there's this whole lost leader idea that if you give away music for free or very cheap, it makes people more excited and interested in the artist. It's better marketing. It's better publicity. And then you can sell something more expensive later, like a concert ticket.
And that's what Springsteen's been doing, right?
Springsteen did that. He put out two free MP3s. And then, you know, of course, he was on the halftime show at the Super Bowl, which was great publicity. And the very next day, he went on sale with these concert tour tickets, and his tour is doing amazingly well.
Now we're also seeing the rise of discount competitors. I'm thinking about e-music, and they mostly have independent acts, but you can get some of the same music, depending on what you subscribe to, for 29 or 39 cents a track.
Yeah, well, e-music is a slightly different animal because e-music, it focuses on, I should explain, e-music is actually a really great service. It's you pay something like $12 a month for the basic price, and you can get 25 to 50, I forget the number, of downloads, MP3 downloads delivered to your computer, but it's a subscription for that, but it's not major label stuff. It's all independent stuff. So you can get really great albums. You can get, I think, the Arcade Fire is on there, and Spoon is on there, and various, underground independent rock and hip-hop and all kinds of different music is on there, but you won't find the Bruce Springsteen album on there or the Madonna album on there. So it's just sort of like a niche service. I wouldn't call it exactly competitive to iTunes. I would say it's more supplementary to iTunes.
Well, and what's interesting about it, and I wonder what it took to strike this deal, is that when you download something from eMusic, it automatically works with your iTunes account.
Yeah, well, that's partly because what eMusic does is sell MP3s. And MP3s are the most adaptable and also the most difficult to restrict type of compressed audio files that you can download on your computer. There's no copy protection on there, and there's nothing on there that makes it incompatible with, for example, your iTunes music library. So it's fairly simple. I'm not a big technology guy, but I think it's fairly simple from a software perspective to download something on eMusic and make it possible to just jump right to your iTunes folder if that's what you want.
How much influence do you think services like Rhapsody, which, if I understand correctly, you don't own any of the music, but you can listen to anything you want?
For the most part, although Rhapsody does sell MP3s, that's not the biggest part of its service, but Rhapsody has definitely made its reputation as a subscription service, a streaming music subscription service. And it's doing okay. You know, I think they have anything available that you want, and it's incredibly compelling. And in fact, I was on a panel at South by Southwest with Tim Quirk, one of the executives at Rhapsody, who used to be in this great band, Too Much Joy. And so he was talking about a lot of these issues, too. He's actually a pretty articulate, smart guy. Rhapsody is a very, very powerful model. You can subscribe for something like $12 a month, and you can listen to any song that's out there, anything you want at any time. It's like the ultimate radio station, and you can do it on your computer. There are ways using the Sonos system to sync it with your home stereo speakers, and also there are portable devices that have Rhapsody. But there are a couple of weaknesses to the service, I would say. I mean, one is that it's definitely, you rent the music, you don't own it. So, you know, for those of us who have been collecting music and like the idea of amassing a lot of music in our personal collections, it's not like that. It's more like having a big radio station.
So you can't burn all this to a CD and take it with you in your car.
Exactly. And the other thing is that it's not compatible at the moment with iTunes. So if you have all your music on your iTunes library or you have an iPod, you can't really play Rhapsody. I should say easily. People can figure out how to do anything they want. But for most of us consumers who aren't, you know, super technologically savvy, it's very difficult to sync Rhapsody with Apple products. And so that's kind of a problem as well.
We have an email here from David, listening at work in Richardson, who says, it's important to note that the record industry figures about what it lost to file sharing services were based on the assumption that every file downloaded represented a lost sale. That is, had the song not been available on the internet, the person would have gone to the record store and purchased it. Can you elaborate on that point?
Yeah, I actually agree with his point. I mean, he's basically saying that, you know, the record label said, oh my God, we're losing all these sales to piracy. All these people are getting the music for free, and therefore they're not going to the store to buy it. But he's saying you're not acknowledging another reality, which is that if I discover some new song on the Napster or the LimeWire or the Kazaa or whatever supposedly illegal file sharing services out there, I might get really into that band and get so into them that I might go buy all their CDs. Or I might be a lifelong fan and go to go buy a concert ticket. And in fact, there's this band called Dispatch that sort of proves that point. During the late '90s, Dispatch was an independent band. They're kind of a an improvisational band, and they basically were a young band. No one had ever heard of them in the late 90s, and they said, let's not sign to a major label. Let's flood Napster with all our music, and let's market it using the Internet. And they did that, and they were incredibly successful. And over time, they built such a huge concert following that just a few years ago, they were able to headline several nights at Madison Square Garden in New York. And even though, you know, you and I may have not necessarily heard of them, but they built up their crowd in this underground way. And so I think that that was the power of Napster. And that's one of the things that my book suggests, is that had the record labels made a deal with Napster or tapped into its power in some way, they could have really had an interesting new model. Yeah, they would have given away some of their sales because people like free music and whatnot. But on the other hand, they could have built up this whole new marketing and publicity mechanism that was more powerful than perhaps anything that they'd had in the past.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Steve Knopper is here. His new book is called Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. Next on the line, we have Kevin in Dallas. Hello, Kevin.
How's it going? Hi.
Great.
I had a question, well, kind of a comment and question, kind of a hybrid. As the digital age progresses, we see things like, you know, people being able to download things on the Internet faster, people hard drives on their computers with more space, and there's been kind of a shift happening. People have, you know, it started with the music industry, and now it's progressing to things like movies and video games, and people are able to get not only, like, low-quality things for movies now, but they're able to get extremely high-quality with, you know, space going up and things like that. But as this progression kind of is happening here, how do you think the other industries are going to handle these threats? I mean, do you think they're going to look at what the recording industry did and kind of make a new model, or how do you think they would approach it? Kind of, do you think they're going to let it happen, or do you think they're going to collaborate with the file sharers? Because I know overseas they've been having a lot of legal debate and legal battles with recording industries and all kinds of industries with, the Pirate Bay, and they've kind of come to a standstill with their cases over there, to where the recording industry or whoever is filing these cases doesn't really have a case against these file distributing places on the Internet, because, I mean, it's not really something that they host. It's something that everybody hosts. I mean, what are they really going to do about all this new wave of technology and these new industries? How do you say they'd handle that?
Kevin, thanks for your call. Do you think, Steve, that video and movie distributors are learning something from what happened with the record industry?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm actually not a huge movie industry expert, so I can't tell you exactly what all the things are that the movie industry is doing. But I get asked that a lot, as you can imagine. You know, will the movie industry have its own Napster problem? And I guess I have a couple of reactions to that. The first thing is, to an extent, I think that the movie industry is what, I mean, they've had the advantage that the music business went first, and the book industry is in the same position. So they've been able to watch and see what the mistakes were that were made. And at least when I was writing the book, a lot of the major movie studios had deals with BitTorrent, the kind of business arm of the peer-to-peer file sharing service, to have some kind of distribution deal. So that suggests that they're looking at things a little bit more progressively, although I couldn't say for sure how progressive they are. But I will say, and perhaps this is Pollyanna-ish of me, but I will say that I think that the movie industry has a little bit of a built-in defense against this thing, and to an extent the book industry, because I think that people like to consume music in bulk. I think music it's all two-minute pop songs, or the mainstream way of consuming music is two or three or four-minute pop songs. And so you like to collect these. You like to have thousands. It makes sense to have thousands and thousands and thousands of these songs in your personal collection to have at the ready for whatever mood you may be in. That doesn't work so well with movies, I don't think. I mean, of course there are bulk collectors, but the mainstream movie fan is someone like me who, you know, on Saturday night, I want to go see a movie with my wife. And so we go and we pay our $8, and that's that. We don't necessarily have to have thousands of movies lying around that we can pick from at any moment. And I also think the Netflix model speaks to that, because, you know, you pay $9.99 or $19.99 or something like that, and you get four or five DVDs sent to you every month, and that's really enough. That's really all you need. The Netflix model kind of makes so much sense that it doesn't seem to me that I need to circumvent that with some kind of, you know, renegade Napster-style music sharing service where I can get everything for free. So I do think the movie business is to an extent insulated, and it also helps that it's still, even after all these years of broadband and, like the caller said, data storage and so forth, of these advantages in those areas, it's still pretty difficult to download a movie. Of course, you'll have people who call up and say, oh, I do it all the time. But I think for the mainstream person, it's not nearly as easy to do that as it is with music.
What sort of influence does FM radio have these days on the music that people are listening to and that they ultimately purchase?
Well, FM radio is still really the most efficient way to, from a business perspective, it's the most efficient way for an artist to get a huge hit. And that's always been traditional. You know, if you're a nobody, no one's ever heard of you, and you make music, and you want to be a superstar, the easiest and most efficient way to do it is to sign with a major record label still and use their vast connections to get your song on the radio. And that's still true, and to an extent it might always be true. But, you know, listenership has been slowly declining for music radio, for FM radio, over the past 10 years as people have more choice with their iPods and Rhapsody and also satellite radio and internet radio and all these different things. So its influence has declined as well. I mean, gone are the days of 1998 or 1999 where the major label working with the top radio station in the market could create an 11 million selling juggernaut like the Backstreet Boys or Britney Spears. I think those days are gone perhaps forever. But there still are smaller niches, where that still happens.
Steve Knopper is here. He's a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, and his new book is called Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. We'll be back to the conversation in a moment, and welcome you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Steve Knopper is my guest. He's a contributing editor for Rolling Stone with a new book called Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Steve, you alluded to this earlier, but one phenomenon that I think is fascinating and bears talking more about is this idea that there are bands that are new on the scene that are offered major label record deals and decide to turn them down and go their own way and sort of market things themselves and keep control of their own work.
Yes, I mean that's been happening more and more. You know, bands these days have a choice. We were talking about this in Austin last week. You know, the South by Southwest Music Festival, which deals with a lot of music business issues, has been around since the late 80s. And during the early days in the 90s, if you wanted to do that process of being a nobody who gets discovered and becomes a huge megastar, there was only one way you could do it, and that was by signing with a major label and getting on the radio. That was the only path you had. But of course, now there are a lot of different paths. You can market yourself with Facebook or MySpace. You can try to do the Radiohead approach, which is sort of give your music away on the internet and have people pay whatever they want. You can get a novelty video on YouTube and build a following and get a lot of hits that way, and then suddenly start trying to sell people stuff through MySpace or whatever else. And there's a lot of it's a wide open terrain. There's a lot of things that new bands, established bands can do, established acts I should say, to get themselves heard above the din. Of course, now the challenge is different, which is there are so many acts trying to do that same thing, hundreds of thousands of them all around the world trying to get heard, that there becomes this signal-to-noise issue. And a lot of people become very frustrated with that, and it's just as difficult to kind of pierce through the noise and get big as it always has been, and that's kind of the challenge. So far to date, I would say that no artist has really become a megastar purely through breaking on the Internet. There are examples of artists such as Colby Calais or Secondhand Serenade who have broken and become somewhat big artists purely through MySpace marketing. But they wound up being signed by major record labels to take the next step and become huge. So it'll be interesting. I think that process has yet to happen. I think it still will. And I actually, from a journalist perspective, I think it's really exciting and interesting to follow all the different new models that people are taking to try to get themselves heard these days.
You can send us email to think@kera.org. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
I have a comment, and maybe he could address my comment. I think the part of the music industry that's most being hurt by this is the classical music section, partially because the market's relatively smaller, partially because the pieces are for the most part, much, much longer, and then there's always the old fuddy-duddies like me that haven't quite gotten into all of the other stuff.
Right. You know, I would say that, I mean, I don't follow classical music. I write for Rolling Stone magazine, so obviously my area is more rock and pop-oriented, so I should be upfront about that. But my sense is that the old fuddy-duddy aspect of what you just mentioned is actually somewhat of a good thing for the classical market, at least temporarily, because that insulates, you know, generally speaking, and I realize I'm stereotyping here, I think that older people are less enthusiastic to jump into the Internet and do illegal file sharing than younger kids are. And so therefore, it becomes easier to sell not only classical music on traditional old-fashioned high-profit margin CDs, but also it becomes easier to sell, for example, Barry Manilow albums or Rod Stewart's pop standards albums. As it has over the last few years. And those artists have had pretty huge number one records, and I think that's sort of what's going on there. There's some debate right now about, are certain genres of music more impervious to this problem of downloading than others? Some people suggest that country music is less affected by downloading than other genres of music, and I think the numbers sort of bore that out for a while. But I think right now we're starting to see all of it be affected by the same thing together. And frankly, you know, classical music has the same issue. When it really comes down to it, I feel it has the same issue as any other genre, from jazz to hip-hop to world music, which is have a good product, market it well, and, you know, you'll do okay. Maybe you won't sell 11 million records like you did 10 years ago, but you'll still do okay.
Yeah, let's talk about the number one selling album last year and how many copies that actually, something like 3 million copies?
Yes, the number one selling album, if I'm not mistaken, last year was the Lil Wayne album, and it sold something like 2.8 million copies. And so, you know, that's a lot of copies, but it's not nearly a lot of copies when you look at the sales statistics from the year 2000, when you see that the top 10 albums of that year all sold significantly more copies than last year's Lil Wayne album. So looking at the top 10s, not only the end of the year top 10s, but also the weekly top 25 or whatever that come out through Billboard every week, it's really, these numbers are very, very low. I mean, the U2 album came out a couple weeks ago, and its first week numbers were 480,000. And that seems like a lot, but it wasn't so long ago that U2 could sell in the millions and that's that in the first week, and that's just not happening anymore. So it's really, that is definitely a gauge that everybody is looking at to see the slow, gradual decline of CDs.
An email from Mark in Garland asks if you would talk about whether changes in the industry have been a net help financially for the artists themselves.
It depends. Some artists, yes, and some artists, no. And it sort of depends on how savvy they are and how well they market themselves. What we've seen over the last, I would say, 8 or 10 years is a shift in the balance of power in the entire music business from recorded music to the concert business. Recorded music has just declined steadily, whereas concert ticket sales have gone up and up and up, and the millions and billions of dollars that have been made are just more and more every year. So, you know, when Madonna comes out with that tour that sells $350 tickets, she's doing pretty well. And so there's still a high demand, and that concert experience can't really be pirated for the most part. And some would suggest that there's even a new pool, although this we're getting into controversial territory here, but there's a new pool of money potentially that the concert business could make, which is the secondary market, the ticket scalpers. And that, you know, some people say that that has potential to be the next Napster for the concert industry, because it's kind of taking away money that artists could have made. But others are suggesting that if they could only get into that market, and we see Ticketmaster take some steps in that direction somewhat controversially, then that's a huge, huge multi-million dollar pool of money that is available to artists. So, you know, those are the artists that are at the top. I mean, the Madonnas, the Britney Spearses, the Bruce Springsteens, they're still doing just as well as ever money-wise. And I would argue the mid-level artists, the ones who have sort of the traditional kind of, we would sell 200,000 or 300,000 units of an album in the old days, the Wilcos or the Radioheads, they're doing pretty well too, because they can, the Nine Inch Nailses, they can communicate and sell more directly to their fans than ever before. And that's a pretty lucrative model for them as well. So are all artists doing better? No, not necessarily. There are some who are signed to major labels that do it the traditional way, who are not really that interested in you know, becoming MySpace marketing experts. And they're having some trouble. They're trying to figure out how to speak the language of this new marketplace, and perhaps aren't finding themselves doing it very easily. And so I think those artists may have a bit of a learning curve, or they may fade away, or they may just have smaller audiences in the future.
Let's go next to Arlington, where we find Adam on the line. Hey, Adam.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious if your guest would talk about what effect whiny millionaire musicians like, you know, Lars Ulrich and Master P protesting Napster a lot back in the day. I was wondering if they actually had any effect on things, or if they were just blowing hot air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think Dr. Dre, I'm not sure if it was Master P, you might be right, but I think it was Metallica and Dr. Dre and Eminem who were at the time some of the top people protesting Napster and saying, you know, if you download music for free, we're the artists and we're not getting paid.
Ironically, this outlaw image kind of mixed with these bands that then really went hard after people who were illegally downloading.
Yeah, I mean, that was a problem that Metallica had. I'm not totally sure that, and I have no way of knowing this because, you know, I didn't wind up interviewing. They weren't available for my book either. But I wonder if Metallica regrets the Napster fight a little bit, because they did take a publicity hit on that. You know, they were seen as sort of the people's band. They were the band that was positioned against society. You know, for a long time, they were the underground metal band that made it big. And then when Napster came out, they sort of spoke for the establishment. And they were speaking for artists' rights, and I think that was legitimate. But I think initially the debate over Napster was framed purely as artists have the right to make money. But I think as time went on, it became clear that this is a more expansive, a much more complex discussion, instead of just, oh, Napster's taking away our money. You know, there are opportunities for artists that were out there through things like Napster and through using downloading in the Internet, and we've certainly seen that today, and a lot of these acts are using those very effectively. And so, you know, I think that the challenge becomes today not, let's shut Napster down, let's shut file sharing down. I think the challenge is sort of, well, how can we use this stuff to our advantage? And the savvy artists like Radiohead or Nine Inch Nails or even Bruce Springsteen to an extent are actually doing a very good job of that and will continue to do so probably.
How effectively do you think record labels and artists are using services like Pandora in order to market their music to people who might not have found them otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, Pandora is a little bit of an interesting case because Pandora, you know, relies on Internet radio, and Internet radio has its own set of issues. And there have been some debates about the rates that Internet radio stations have to pay to the publishing entities, the people who make money off songwriting, you know, the traditional outlets that make money whenever radio plays a song. These people are demanding their cut for Internet radio as well, and they say it's only fair. But the problem is that some of the raised fees that they propose over recent years have been so large that some of the mom-and-pop Internet radio-type stations have been crippled by this. So there's been a huge debate. There have been some compromises. The most recent one has allowed most of the stations to stay in business. And since Pandora is a bit of an aggregator of all these different Internet radio stations, its fortunes sort of rely on what happens with this rate discussion, and it rises and falls based on that. Having said all that, I think Pandora is a great service. I have it on my iPhone. I've used it a little bit. And, you know, it's just like eMusic or Rhapsody or MySpace or any of these other things that we're talking about. It's a great discovery service. And I agree with you that fans who use it tend to discover a lot of new music, and it can be used for you know, making a band better known and marketing and publicity as well.
I'm curious, Steve, as to what you think about this. Does music still have the power to sort of unify generations in the way that it did when we and even our parents were in high school and college? Because I'm thinking, you know, I may not have liked every one of them, but I could tell you 50 songs that were big in the era that I was first discovering music. And I wonder if kids now have that same sort of shared experience.
Yeah, I have a bit of a cockamamie half-baked theory that I've been working on that very question. So if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
The theory is that in the 60s, everybody liked the Beatles, you know, so the Beatles were a universally something communal that everybody could relate to. Every person of a certain age had a copy of the White Album in their home, or the Stones, or there were certain other things. And over time, I mean, even before the internet, starting really in the 80s and 90s, this whole thing started to fragment, and there were genres and subgenres, and then suddenly you had people who like metal and people who like hip-hop, and then you had people who like hardcore metal and pop metal, and everything was dividing up quickly into these little categories, and so it was all fragmenting. So and I think that the internet just accelerated that, because there were little tiny communities that could get together on the internet based on some tiny, tiny subgenre of music. I actually think, and this is where my cockamamie theory comes in, I actually am starting to see that change a little bit, because I think that today everybody has access to the same music. So I think the proverbial top 40 fan, the one who liked Mariah Carey in the 90s and would never have set foot into some indie record store to go buy the the Uncle Tupelo record. My mom.
No Uncle Tupelo on her shelf?
Well, I'm sorry?
No Uncle Tupelo on your mom's shelf?
Right. No, not exactly. She loves Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond. You know, she potentially, you know, could be exposed to that sort of stuff in a greater way than ever before, the Uncle Tupelo, you know, the proverbial Uncle Tupelos of the world, because she's on Facebook or she's on MySpace, and she could go to my page or some other person's page and be exposed to all this different stuff. So it's starting to strike me that everybody listens to everything more so than they ever did, because it's right there in front of them. You know, the people who supposedly were trapped in their prison of only listening to top 40 radio, they're not in that prison anymore. They're on Facebook. So they're exposed to the Bon Iver song or the Fleet Foxes song. And it's just a song. It pops up in their consciousness and they go, this is a great song. And I don't have to, there's no barrier to entry anymore. So I'm starting to wonder if that whole communal idea is coming back a little bit. But again, I would not be able to tell you I've fleshed out this idea fully or looked at any numbers to prove it.
Well, we'll wait for the article maybe where you cover that. Steve Knopper is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. The new book is called Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. Steve, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Chris, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.